Welcome to the Software Process and Measurement Cast number 496. We are getting very close to the milestone of 500 episodes. I'm Tom Cagley, your host, and in the Spamcast 496, we feature our interview with Sam Lang. Sam and I talked about coaching agile teams. The goal of coaching is to help people unleash their inner power. We also touch on the difference between coaching and mentoring. They are different and require different approaches, but both are useful. Sam's bio. Sam writes, "My personal motto is be brave. I embody this by taking on challenges one small step at a time. Most of my career has been in the IT industry, specifically software development. Nowadays, I find myself guiding and mentoring others with a passion for Agile. This year, my focus has been on experimenting and learning from my failures and successes. What a great journey so far." Are you ready to talk Agile coaching with Sam Lang? It's time for the interview. Sam Lang, welcome to the Software Process and Measurement Cast.
Thank you.
Sam, you come highly recommended as an experienced coach. Why don't we just dive right into the deep end? What do you think is the single most important competency for somebody to work more efficiently?
More efficiently or more effectively?
What's the difference?
So to me, efficient is about being as timeous as possible with a task. And effectiveness is more about thinking, should you be doing the task in the first place? And is there another way to do the task?
So why don't we tackle effectively then?
Okay. So effectively, I would then say it's probably the ability to do the task. If someone is working with something and they don't know anything about it, it's really difficult for them to be effective. If the task is learning and they don't actually know how to learn, then they're really, really going to struggle. So I think it's having the ability to do the task.
Do you think it's hard for people to recognize whether or not they can do the task or not, and that they have a degree of competency to allow them to be effective?
I don't think people struggle to know whether they can do a task or not. I think they struggle, especially when you get older, you realize you can't do everything, but you also realize you could probably learn about it if you tried. I think for juniors, this is a lot more difficult because they feel they have no confidence and they're not sure when to give up and ask for help and when to keep struggling.
Is it hard for people to admit some organizations are just not safe to admit that you can't do something, so they'll struggle too long. There are others where it's safe to admit that, and then I think your answer works. How do you, as a coach, help sort that out and help people learn to know when to struggle and not know when to struggle?
So as a coach, my first duty, that's a terrible word, but I don't have another one to replace it, so I'm going to go with it. The first thing I look for is trust. And the first thing I build is trust. So trust between team members, trust between managers and workers, trust between me and whomever I'm coaching. And I look for signs of trust and I look for signs that there's no trust. And I start to build on that, because if there's absolutely no trust, then you're not going to get very far.
How do you know when there's trust or not? As a coach, what are the signs that you're looking for?
So as a coach, I look for signs of people being themselves as opposed to saying what other people want to hear. It's easy to notice trust when someone can be very honest about failing something or doing something and the rest of the team is, "Oh, no worries, how can we help with that?" Then there's a definite level of trust there. But when people start justifying and making excuses for something, then there's usually something I need to dig into and uncover. because something else is happening.
Who typically owns that something else? Is that an organizational problem? Is that a team problem? Is that an individual? Or is it some mishmash of all three?
Oh, I think it's a mishmash of all three. It could be that someone came in, they just had a fight with their spouse, and so they were overreacting. It could be that, I don't know, someone in the office forgot to pay them, and they were upset about that. It could be a myriad of things. It could be anything. And my job is to give them space and to build the trust so that they're able to come to work and be their whole selves. So if they had a bad day or they had a fight with their spouse, it's okay. You're allowed to do that. And when you come to work, it's okay to be in a bad mood. But you also have to let your teammates know, I'm in a bad mood, so that they can all understand that you're not angry with them. You're just in a bad mood.
How important is it for a coach to be, or at least show empathy or be able to read other people?
I think it also depends on what type of coach you are.
Okay.
So for me, it's very important because I'm dealing with people's emotions and their well-being and how they show up with others. For a technical coach that's working on improving your, I don't know, let's go with your Java skills, it might not be as important. I think any interaction with people requires some level of empathy, but it might not be as important.
So what is then, using yourself as the model, and I think you've said you're the more empathetic kind of coach, what is the most important attribute that makes a good coach?
I think patience. Patience and having loosely held strong opinions. And what I mean by that is you need to be open to any ideas or concepts that the person you're coaching brings up without judging them and without going, well, I don't believe this, and listing your reasons and totally overpowering them. So the patience to let them talk about what's important to them without interjecting. And also the ability to hold your beliefs and your values in check for yourself whilst allowing them to hold their beliefs and their values.
Then why is it important for a coach to have strongly held opinions?
Huh. Now I'm wondering why I said that. I think that's a personal preference. I personally like having interactive debates with people when they have an opinion over something, purely to learn why they feel so strongly about something, not to change their minds or to change my mind, just to have a good argument. I don't think it's necessary in every coach. It's just what I prefer.
I could see that it would be important to be able to have those debates. And I actually liked the idea of loosely held strong opinions as creating some sort of fundamental underpinning so that you could have those kinds of discussions. You're a coach. Do you actually have a coach for yourself?
I do have a coach. At the beginning of the year, when I was working with Karen, my business partner, we had a business coach and we actually got coached together. So we would have sessions together. It was almost like couples counseling. And we would have individual sessions. And that was extremely beneficial to us. I now have a coach that I practice with. So we will have coaching sessions with each other so that we can practice a particular technique or skill that we're trying to improve on.
How did you decide on your coach? So if we use that as a model, right? And people need coaching, and I think that's probably something that's, I think easy to agree on. How does one go about finding one? And would you hold up the model that you used to determine who was going to coach you and your business partner as a model for others?
I don't know if I'd hold it up as a model. It definitely worked for us. What we did was we found someone we respected in the community and we asked them to coach us. And she actually said to us that she feels she's too close to us and we're in too similar a space, but she can recommend someone who's not in the agile industry at all, like a pure business coach. And the person she recommended turned out to be absolutely amazing. We did do some Googling and find some people ourselves, and we had one or two sessions with these other people, and it was dreadful. It fell completely flat. They didn't understand us or where we were coming from. So I think having someone who knows you and your dynamic recommend someone for you was very helpful.
Why is it helpful to have a coach?
It was helpful because that was our last resort, was asking someone we knew. We tried to do it ourselves first to find a coach for ourselves. And after three failed attempts, we were kind of getting a bit disillusioned. Maybe we can't find a coach. So our last attempt ended up getting the recommended coach that actually changed our lives this year.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Would you recommend coaches to have coaches?
Definitely. I don't understand how you can be a coach and not have a coach.
Interesting.
I don't understand the concept of telling people they need to be coached, but you don't think you need to be coached.
Do you differentiate between the idea of a coach and a mentor? Are those different in your mind?
In my mind, they are very different. As a coach, I show up expecting and knowing in my heart that you already have all the answers. I'm just here to help you uncover them. And as a mentor, I show up trying to impart a skill so that you can learn that skill.
Yeah, those are very different. Do you ever see those two things overlapping, sort of being a Venn diagram with some degree of overlap?
So if we talk about agile coaching, I see a lot of agile coaches who prefer mentoring to coaching. And there isn't really a term agile mentor. It all falls under agile coach. So agile coaches have different specialities, I would say. Some of them love pure coaching and some of them love mentoring. And I think it gets a bit confusing when someone wants coaching and they end up getting mentoring or vice versa.
Interesting. I often find that, especially with people who are new to concepts, that you almost have to start with mentoring and then hopefully transition to coaching. Albeit that's a very hard transition, and it may almost have to be different people.
Yeah, I think if someone gets to know you as a mentor, it's going to be very hard for you to step out of that role of giving advice and guiding. I feel the exact opposite to you. Mm-hmm. I feel that sometimes I mentor when I didn't need to. Even though I thought they needed to understand a concept, actually, if I had just coached them, they would have gone there in their own time and it would have been a much stronger lesson.
If you stepped back, how would you have determined whether or not that you shouldn't have been a mentor in that circumstance and you should have been a coach? Is there some trigger that you would have seen, that you could have seen?
A trigger in the beginning or a trigger afterwards?
Yeah, so you look at it afterwards and say, I probably should have been a coach in this circumstance versus a mentor. Again, given what you know, was there something that you could have seen up front that would have told you that?
Honestly, I should just always be a coach. That's the lesson I'm trying to learn.
Ah, okay.
Because it's happening more and more often that I'm questioning why I mentored or why I trained as opposed to coached. So I think for me, it's just getting into the habit of rather coaching than mentoring.
How difficult of a transition has that been?
Oh, very difficult. I fail every day. It's difficult to also, how can I put this? When you're coaching, someone has to ask to be coached. You can't inflict coaching on them. And a lot of people don't know to ask for coaching. And so they ask you direct questions, which means you give them direct answers and you automatically fall into a mentor role. With the team I'm currently working with, I am offering them coaching sessions every week. And I'm finding that they're now pulling coaching as opposed to asking questions, which is working well for us. Yeah, I guess time will tell how well it works.
In your practice, are the teams all co-located, all in the same place, or are they distributed that you're dealing with?
We have kind of a combined model. So the team was all over the place. And what we agreed, because there were a lot of problems that came out of that, what we agreed was that on a Monday and a Friday, everyone would be in the office. And if they had to travel, it would be a Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. And on the odd occasion, if they're out of the country, they might not be there on a Monday or Friday. But the general rule is for local travel, it's only midweek and everyone is in the office together. We're also going to try a new experiment in January where everyone works from home on one day so that we can actually practice getting better at remote working.
What's the biggest issue that you see in remote working scenarios?
I think the biggest issue is that the people who are co-located still have a completely normal meeting. And the person, one or two people who are remote dialing in, have a completely different experience of the meeting. And so it's not a collaborative meeting anymore. It's a bunch of people in a room who are reading body language and seeing a different conversation happening to the two people perhaps on the phone line who aren't having the same experience. And so I try, which is why we're going to try the one day a week, everyone works remotely so that everyone can experience what it's like to be remote, as well as if we're all remote, is it better than some are remote, some are co-located?
So let's say you run this where people are all remote. How do you generate the conversation where people can learn from that experience? How are you going to generate that feedback?
I would probably just ask them. Our team has quite a high trust level, so they will very quickly tell you if something's working for them or not working for them. We also, I think, a big part of our trust level is we have a regular lean coffee where everyone is encouraged to air any dirty laundry and get it off their chest so that we do that once a week so that the following week is fresh and clean and no issues are being dragged into it. So I don't think that'll be a problem getting feedback from them.
How did you get to a position where the team actually had the level of trust that you're describing? I mean, I work with a lot of teams that I would suggest wouldn't air their dirty laundry, not in front of themselves or perhaps even, you know, their leaders.
So there's a few of us on the team, I would say three of the probably eight people who have known each other for a really, really long time, I think 10 years. So we are friends. And you would think that would create a click, but what it's done instead is we've become friends with everyone else in the office and made a lot more effort because of it. So we would have a regular dinner out and we'd go for drinks and we all go for breakfast together and we all go for coffees. And so there's a lot of stuff happening where people just pair up or go in groups of three to have lunch and that. And we get to know each other very, very differently and on a different level when that happens. Just this week, we're working with a team of people who aren't part of our company, but who are going to work with us closely for 2 months. And they're from another part of the country. And they came down to spend this week with us. And we've been out for lunch and dinners every single night this week. And they feel like family already. We know everything about them and they know everything about us. Dirty laundry, clean laundry, everything.
You indicated that the three of you put in a lot more effort. Was that a conscious choice? Was that something you said, hey, we need to build or help build this level of trust?
It was kind of happening by accident. When we recognized how well it was working, we started being more deliberate about it. So instead of asking the same people to go for coffee the whole time, we deliberately asked different people.
When you made the deliberate choice, did the effectiveness change?
It definitely became more effective.
Okay.
What we've noticed is because we're making the effort of asking different people, the rest of the team are now also making the effort of asking different people.
That's an interesting thought process. Agile is, whether it's Agile, I'd actually suggest that all software development, whether it's Agile or, God forbid, Waterfall, is mostly about people. Many coaches, many methodologists really are, I think, almost obsessed with process and techniques. You must do a stand-up. You must do a retrospective. It must be 32 seconds long. Why the obsession versus obsessing over people?
I think it's easier to tick the check boxes for a process, right? I don't think anyone wakes up and goes, I'm going to, you know, regardless of what anyone says, we're going to do this process because I think it will work. I think everyone's trying to do it because they really believe it's going to work. The tricky part there is noticing when it's not working and then tweaking it and figuring out what is going to work, not by yourself, but letting everyone figure out what's going to work for them. So bring your experience to the table, but don't enforce something on people. Well, that's my preferred way of working.
Have you ever watched where it was quote unquote enforced, and what was the outcome that you observed?
Oh no, I've been that person. I've learned that lesson the hard way. People hated it. They hated. I think I forced Scrum on a few teams. And they absolutely hated it. And as soon as I left, it fell apart because no one wanted to own it. No one cared about it. They were just doing it because I was forcing them to do it. It was terrible.
Those organizations, what was the long term? Did they ever come back to something that was better for them?
I didn't think they would ever touch Agile again with a barge pole, but they did. They're actually doing SAFe now, and they've been doing it for about 4 years, and they're doing really, really well. They enjoy it. It's a happy environment. The teams love it. I'm just glad I didn't do any permanent damage.
Well, I think we all hope that in the end. Sam, I think this has been absolutely a marvelous conversation. If you woke up tomorrow morning and somebody handed you your morning caffeinated beverage and a magic wand and said that you had the power to change any two things impacting how coaching was done, what would those two things be and why?
What a lovely question. I think it would be that people didn't view coaching as something that happened when you were underperforming or in trouble. So that would be the first thing. And the second thing, perhaps that coaching becomes a part of people's lives from when they're very young. So perhaps that even kids at school get exposed to coaching and thinking for themselves and that kind of thing.
It's funny because, at least here in the States, most kids play sports at one point in form or another. And while I think there's a combination of mentorship, you might say, but there are also coaches involved, you know, people helping them learn to be better and helping them explore what they are. I think it's funny that we then stop immediately once we get into the professional world and say, okay, you know, I'm done with that, and I won't explore that. And I guess maybe people don't like the sports analogies, but heck, even professional sports people have coaches. I mean, and have coaches that are personally helping them learn to be better.
Well, most professionals have more than one coach helping them be amazing.
Why do we just, and so I'm agreeing, I like your two things with the magic wand, but why is that, why do we step away from that? Why is that so hard to remember that we should get coaching as a professional in the business world?
Yeah, I don't have the answer to that.
Yeah, I think we're all looking for that answer. And someday I'm going to ask the question, and I'm going to get an answer that makes sense to me. So I agree. I don't know what the answer is either, but happy to continue exploring it. Sam, this has been absolutely fantastic. If people wanted to continue the conversation with you, how would they go about finding you on the web, continuing the conversation?
They can find me on Twitter. I'm at Sam Lang, S-A-M-L-A-I-N-G. They can also go to our website, www.growingagile.co.za. And my email address is on there. So is Karen's, my business partner. So you can get hold of us in various ways.
And I will have all of that contact information on the show notes. Sam, as you may know, at this point in the podcast interview, I step back and say, hey, the platform's yours. You've provided a lot of very interesting and thought-provoking information to the Software Process and Measurement Cast listeners. The platform's yours to promote anything that you'd like.
Thank you very much. If you do go to our website, we have books and online courses. They're quite specific to Agile, the Agile space, specifically Scrum Masters and product owners. If you are a coach, there are some books that you might find interesting, things like facilitation techniques and tips to help teams with productivity. So they might help you with some tools for your tool belt.
Well, we will have those links in the show notes. Sam Lang, thank you again for participating on the Software Process and Measurement Cast.
Thank you for having me.
As we get to the spam, as we close in on the Spamcast 500, I'm looking for your thoughts on how we make the Software Process and Measurement Cast even better for the next 500 episodes. Please reach out to us at spamcastinfo@gmail.com. Leave a message on the hotline at 01-440-668-5717 or record a message on your smart device and send it to spamcastinfo@gmail.com. I'm interested in what would make this a better show for the next 500 episodes. In Reread Saturday News, we're in week 11 of the reread of L. David Marquet's Turn the Ship Around. Remember to buy your copy. This week, we begin part 3 of the book and add 2 more mechanisms to our tool belt. This week, the 2 chapters are Mistakes Just Happen, and We Learn. In the Software Process and Measurement Cast 497, we'll feature our essay on micromanagement. Micromanagement is almost always a bad idea. The problem is that people still do it and then rationalize the behavior. We will hold forth on the topic. We'll also have columns from Gene Hewson and Dr. Susan Parente.